Hello, and welcome to The Advance, conversations about news in the Mid-America Union Conference of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I'm Pablo Colindres, Digital Media Manager at the MAUC. This week, we have a special episode coming your way. It is no secret that Islam has been receiving a lion's share of news coverage lately, and not always positive. According to research, however, Islam is the fastest growing religion, both in the United States and abroad. My guest today is Doug Hart, who spent 8 years working in a predominantly Muslim part of the world as a pastor and recently published a book titled Who Was Muhammad? We talk about his experiences at home and overseas with Islam and Muslims and about his book. Enjoy.
All right, I guess we can get started. If you can introduce yourself, who you are, what you do.
Okay.
Stuff, so.
Yeah, my name is Doug Hart. I'm a pastor in the Iron Range District of northern Minnesota. I have 5 churches and 2 groups up there on the Canadian border. And but previously was trying to start up a center for interfaith studies and here at Union College and working at our Good Neighbor Center. And before that, I was working overseas for the church in predominantly Muslim part of the world.
Okay. Yeah, and I brought you in here today because, well, you came on your own, but we're talking today because you wrote a book called Who Was Muhammad? And you're analyzing who the prophet Muhammad was based on the Bible and the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember taking a class from you at Union College called mm-hmm. Understanding Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised that I didn't know almost anything about Islam. I thought I knew the couple like key things,
mm-hmm.
but in all honesty, I had no idea what was going on. Is that something you can relate to?
Oh, absolutely. I grew up in Grand Island, Nebraska. My parents taught out here, and then in Minnesota, Hutchinson, Minnesota, my parents taught in Adventist academies, and I didn't move overseas till I was 30 years old, and when I got to Azerbaijan, which was part of my territory, which is a predominantly Muslim country, 8 million Muslims in the former Soviet Union, I didn't know. I knew a little bit, there was a Muhammad, I know just kind of the visible signs of Islam, the minarets, the prayers. But as far as understanding the religion, the teachings, the culture, I didn't know anything. So I just took it upon myself to start studying.
Right. In your book, you mentioned something about cultural Adventism, which, like you said, growing up an Adventist, mm-hmm. I grew up in second or third generation Adventist.
Yep.
We have this generational thing,
mm-hmm.
which is really unique to Adventists also.
It is.
Did that in some way affect your view of Islam or lack of view of Islam, I guess?
Yeah, well, I think, what's interesting is, growing up as a cultural Adventist, and everybody should be convinced in their own mind that their religion is right, otherwise why belong to it?
Right.
And I always assumed, our Adventist understanding of the Bible was the correct one and grew up with that. Probably how it influenced my view of Islam is that some Adventist interpreters have recently, especially, interpreted the fifth and sixth trumpets of Revelation. And I had studied Revelation, and they interpreted that as the rise of Muhammad and the rise of the Muslims as this kind of scourge upon the earth.
Right.
And so when you, and since it was a, he's a fallen prophet, and there's clouds and out of the abyss, and there's the locusts that descend upon the earth to destroy. It doesn't really lend itself to a positive
right.
understanding of how you can relate to this almost diabolical, militant, religion. And when I first got overseas and started working, actually in Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia, it's called the Caucasus region there. It was September 1, 2001 was my first day on the job. So it was, within a week and a half of the world radically changing, and especially a perception of what Islam stands for and, the violent tendencies that we see in the least aspects of Islam.
Right, yeah, the newsworthy, at least.
The newsworthy aspects of Islam, yes.
So that, yeah, that must have been some transition there within a week and a half. Was there any, how did it affect you as an American in those, in that area?
Well, you know, yeah, it's interesting because I was living in Georgia, which is a Christian country, and I would say overall, there was a lot of empathy towards America. The region where I was serving had seen three wars, and some of it was tinged by Islamic Christian relations, especially between Armenia and Azerbaijan. They'd fought a war. So people understood that, you know, religions, and when people use religion to fight a war, they kind of understand the personal human suffering that goes along with it.
Right.
But as I lived there and we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, I could see the attitude, especially in the Islamic countries, change a bit. You know, on a personal level, people were friendly. But you do see this cultural / religious divide that really became quite clear. And then they have their whole side of, you know, the issues. And I found myself as an American and an Adventist wrestling with, you know, my American understanding and loving my country and wanting to support my country and what it does. And yet hearing my friends who come from a completely different point of view, who were Muslims or even Adventists who are living in Azerbaijan, or other, then I ended up working in the Middle East too, you know, going to Egypt and the Gulf, Kuwait and Bahrain and Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And it was very, it makes you want to have a broader understanding of kind of what's going on, which again contributed to my kind of intellectual / spiritual curiosity of what is going on.
So what was your first contact with Islam?
Well, my first contact with Islam, I remember going across the border right after 9/11 into Azerbaijan. And one of the guards, when he shook my hand, he almost squeezed it off. I couldn't tell if he was like really showing that he was glad I was there, or he wasn't happy that I was there. So, you know, and I'm used to here in the Midwest, you know, in the Mid-America Union, you go from, you know, Nebraska to Iowa to Minnesota, and yes, things change and you see different team colors and you understand that people are rooting for different teams and you have a bit different politics in each state, but overall it's still America. And over there you go from Georgia, a Christian country with their own history and tradition, you go into Azerbaijan, which my house was up on a mountain and I could almost see the Azeri border, so I mean it's right there, but you go across and it's absolutely different. The religion changes, the music changes, the landscape changes. I mean, as far as the type of buildings, the style of the buildings, it was much more Eastern, much more related to Turkey and Iran, and the Azeris are Shia, for instance. You take a flight, which I did from Tbilisi, where I was living in Georgia, just an hour south, which is just like flying from, you know, Lincoln to Denver, Lincoln to Minneapolis, and you're in Iraq. And Iraq is just, you feel like you're a million miles away.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole situation there is different. So I think my experience with Islam was just, and that's why I wrote the book, really, is I wanted other Adventists and Christians and even, you know, Muslims I know are reading the book to analyze some of these issues that really, they really, really divide us. And they do make us feel like we're a long ways away from each other. I remember, actually, the first instance I had, you know, to your question about meeting Muslims here in America was when my daughter was born here in Lincoln. And there was an Arab lady translating for another Arab lady who was giving birth in the hospital. And I asked her what language she was learning, because I was learning Russian at that time, Arab-speaking. And she said, yeah, it's Arabic. It's like, really? Wow, that's interesting. So we ended up having a very nice conversation. She invited us over to her house. Because that's kind of the Eastern way, hospitable. So we went over to their house, and I remember walking in, and here I am in Lincoln, Nebraska, which I spent a good portion of my life here, you know, going to school at Union, and we used to come here all the time when we were living in Platte Valley and even up at Maplewood. And I walked into this house, and there's this, the whole, everything's set up on the floor to eat. So there's no table, no chairs, all the decorations on the wall. I thought I just walked into another world. It was this really strange feeling because I was used to feeling that way overseas, but to come back to Lincoln and have that same feeling of, you know, here I am 5 miles from my parents' house, and I feel like I'm about 5,000. So again, that all started to build up in me of, you know, why this history, what's happened, you know, what is, and then I got with some friends, obviously, and they would say things that would make me think, wow, that's interesting. I need to look into that.
Yeah, so to me, I think that the book was is trying to start building some kind of way for us to start building bridges, right? Some kind of relationship. When you first went overseas, were there any times you did like a faux pas? Did you said something that you had that maybe now you're kind of just a little embarrassed or maybe amused by?
Yeah, that's a good question. I remember, yeah, I was fairly, I tried to be careful because I knew that was a real possibility at all times to, and I was learning another language, which didn't help anything as far as making faux pas and saying stupid stuff and looking like a fool. I remember, yeah, one time, even in, well, here's an example. I was in our church, and I think there were some Muslim visitors there, and I was sitting just like you're sitting now with my feet crossed and my heel being exposed to the person next to me. And the lady tapped my leg and said, please, you know, she understood I was a foreigner and she was very nice about it, but she said, please, can you not have your heel facing me? I was like, yeah, oh, I'm really sorry. I was just doing it for comfort. I wasn't thinking at all, you know. You know, it's my, like making a rude gesture here in America at somebody to show your heel to somebody. So ever after that, I had to be careful because when you go to a Muslim mosque, everybody sits on the floor. Well, you have to cross your legs, but you're trying to cross your legs in such a way that
Your
you're not showing
heels.
heels to people. So that was one thing. Muslim countries, you know, I don't know if I ever offended anybody with this, but you never. You're not supposed to do anything with your left hand at the table because in Muslim countries, and this goes back to the Hadith and how Muhammad the Prophet used to do it and whatever, your left hand is for, there's no toilet paper, so your left hand is your hand for the cleaning because they have water bottles in there. And so when you get to the table, everybody knows your left hand is used for that. You don't go around passing bread or passing
Anything with your left
with your
hand,
left
yes.
hand, which I probably did things with my left hand, not even thinking
Thinking
about
about
it.
it, right?
But yeah, I would have to say people are pretty understanding though of and they're more than willing to tell you if you do just ask them. I mean, for anybody who's listening, if you don't know, it's better to ask and say, you know, is it okay if I do, you know,
This and
whatever,
this, yeah.
or just ask them, you know, I don't want to offend you, and they'll tell you.
To that effect, there's an experience you share here in chapter 7. When you meet a Muslim that converted to Adventism, can you tell me how that went down? Maybe you want to read it, or I don't
No,
know.
yeah, I'll tell you. It was actually a very transformative time in my life because where I was working in Azerbaijan, we actually had probably one of the most successful churches in the world as far as Muslims coming to Adventism. We had about 200 members. It was very interesting. Most of them had seen visions and had seen Christ in a vision, and it was kind of this surreal experience for me. But what I noticed is that as the Soviet Union had fallen apart, all religions were getting weaker except Islam. Islam was kind of regaining its national identity as the religion of the country, and less people were even, you know, seeking to know about other religions. So I went to a conference up in England, and there was a guy there from the Middle East who had converted to Adventism, and I was working, was going to work in the Middle East for the church. So I was talking with him, and I was just curious, well, you know, how did you come? And I asked him that directly, how did you come to understand Jesus? Because that Jesus, kind of the key figure between Christianity and Islam.
Right.
Because we have many, many of the same Bible stories, and they also believe in Jesus as a great prophet. But what I was curious is, how did he make that jump from Jesus a prophet to Jesus as the Messiah and the Son of God? So I asked him directly, and he said, well, you know, the first experiences where I really started to wonder who Jesus was and really came to understand him better was through the Quran. And I was just kind of stunned because I really hadn't studied the Quran. I mean, I knew a little bit of what I thought of what it said, you know, just from hearsay of what other people said it said and what Muslims said it said. And come to find out, you know, Islam has this huge collection of traditions of Muhammad called the Hadith. And then there's the Quran. And even many Muslims aren't sure what is the source for their beliefs. And so I didn't understand that all the time. But when I heard that, I realized there must be something there that I don't understand. If a guy begins his journey to Jesus through the Quran, how would that... it didn't make sense with my current understanding of what the Quran said.
And you do mention in the book also that there are many similarities that we may be not even aware of between the Quran and the Bible. You know, talk me through some of the ones that, I don't know, maybe are more, you know, amazing, like how.
Well, I mean, what was amazing to me, well, the problem with the Quran is that, you know, for anybody listening that hasn't never had any exposure, you know, we went through a little bit in class, but the Quran is not ordered chronologically at all. It's just ordered by the longest chapter to the shortest chapter. So that means that some of the chapters come from completely different time periods. There's no chronological narrative that goes on. So, for instance, if you go in and say, well, who was Joseph in the Quran, or Moses, or Adam, you have to go to many, many different chapters. It's not like going and reading their story in Genesis.
Right. Yeah.
So what I did is I just started going through, and what I was stunned to find out is, I mean, you got the story of Adam and Eve, the story of the fall, the story of Satan fighting against them and being an enemy to mankind. You have the story of Noah. You have the story of Abraham, Jacob, Isaac, Ishmael. You have the story of Moses. You have the stories of David and Solomon. And then you have the virgin birth of Jesus the Messiah, which is just, to me, that was kind of the kicker, is when I thought, wait a minute, we share the story of Christmas with Muslims from the Quran? So, and Jesus in the Quran dies. Allah tells him he's sending him to die. Then he's resurrected, and he's a sign of the Day of Judgment. He's coming back. He could raise the dead. He could create things out of inanimate objects. And probably what stuns most people is that if you were an alien and you just showed up and had no clue the history between Christianity and Islam and terrorism and all the political stuff that goes along with it, and just read both books, you'd come away and say, wow, Jesus is a hero of both books.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's what stunned me probably the most.
So, having Jesus as the centerpiece, basically, as of both books, is that like the opportunity you see to start building some kind of relationship?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that's where most Christians have gone historically. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to, and rightfully so, we want to share Jesus because we do believe he was calling him a special individual is an understatement, you know, in Christianity. However, I found, because it's contentious, usually if we had something we were arguing about, probably the first thing I would do is talk to you about something that's contentious. So my, one of the issues I've had, and I go into it in the book, is that Muslims haven't really read the Bible for about 1,000 years. So if you're going to talk about Jesus, which is something we all want to do because he is special to us as Christians, that you have to lay a foundation for that. And where do we talk about them from? We talk about them from the Bible, but it's the same thing kind of in Western society. That's what's a bit odd to me, mm-hmm. is that if you tear down people's confidence in the Bible, it's hard to talk about an individual that we, everything we know about is from the book they don't really believe in. So to me, building a bridge is, first of all, you have to build a bridge with the Bible. Mm-hmm. Because to understand who the Messiah was, you have to understand the stories of the Old Testament. You have to understand the sanctuary system. You have to understand, the history of God's people and what he showed them and the grace he showed to Abraham and Isaac, Jacob, Moses, David, and Solomon. And you can't do that without the Bible, because the Quran is too, it's too hit or miss.
Right.
However, what I do is I start with the Quran, because the stories are there. While I was here, we started up a Quran Bible study with Christians and Muslims. And both Christians and Muslims came and learned things that were very surprising to them. So it was a really interesting experience, because if you start going through the stories of the Bible, for instance, Adam and Eve, I mean, that's something that you can say, yeah, we share this. Mm-hmm. We all fell, you know, at the story of Satan. It's in the Quran. It's in the Bible. And I think what I've seen is that once Muslims get to the Bible and get to the stories of the Bible, then there's that framework for understanding of why we needed a Messiah. And what's interesting is that Jesus is unequivocally the Messiah in the Quran. So you don't even have to
push that too hard.
No, yeah. Because it's already in the Quran. In fact, that's the term for him, Isa al-Masih, in the Quran. So my thought was, well, you know, how, if Adventists and Christians in general won't read the Quran to know what's in there to talk to Muslims, mm-hmm. and Muslims won't read the Bible, we were like ships passing in the night.
Right.
And we both need to get into each other's scriptures, mm-hmm. to understand what, you know.
Yeah.
What is salvation?
Right. Like, why is it important for us to, especially in our current world atmosphere, is there any urgency you see in the importance of getting to know one another first, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, a couple things. Just the political climate right now is such that there's a lot of fear and distrust on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
I've had Muslims tell me, we like Christians, but we're always afraid deep down that you're going to ask us to become one of you, which entails many things.
Yeah.
It's not just an acceptance of Jesus, because they're very close to us on Jesus. They view Jesus very highly. It's not like we have to speak highly of him. They need to understand, I guess, what the Bible says about who he was, but they already think highly of him. But what they're concerned about a lot is, I understand it's hard, because it was hard for me until I went overseas and lived, and you get immersed in another culture, mm-hmm. and you start to realize how many things, even for instance with other Adventists, I found that I was different as an American and I had a different way of thinking than on many levels, even though we shared the same religion.
Mm-hmm.
So it started to get me to help me to see that, you know, break down, I guess, what is our difference, you know, is it a theological, is it cultural? And I think Islam right now, and the way we treat it in the West, the way they treat Christianity in the West, a lot of it's cultural. And what I'm trying to do is break down to help us see religiously, even though we may be in two different camps. Mm-hmm. You know, most Muslims live in countries that are fairly oppressive about other religions. So there's a lot of fear of even questioning religion.
Right.
So I think when they come here, they like that aspect of it. However, there are elements of the culture here that they miss, that they don't like and miss from back home. People aren't as close to each other here. We're more busy. We're always doing things. We're mm-hmm. not, you know, most Muslims lived in an Eastern culture. Eastern cultures are more, they're just more hospitable. They're kind of warmer. So I think to go that extra mile to understand them, to be able to talk in something that they even phrasing things. For instance, when I go to a mosque, I tell them I'm from the Ahl al-Kitab, which is the way the Quran refers to all the Jews and Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Something small like that. I know it's not a huge deal.
But it's a connection.
But it's a connection. It's an instant connection. And they understand I already have done my homework a little bit. I understand.
You've made an effort.
Yeah. One time, in fact, I remember I was sitting on a couch in some Muslim's home, and I started telling them my understanding of Islamic history on a couple battles, if you remember from class, the Battle of Uhud and the Battle of Badr. And I remember the lady just turned and looked at me, and she said, "You have very good information," which was kind of surprising to me. She understood that I had actually had studied out what had actually happened, how Islam had kind of started. And I just found that it just helps conversations, I mean, and helps to understand each other.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember going off of, you know, how hospitable they are. I remember we took a trip to the masjid, the mosque, and I guess I'd forgotten we were arriving, and they were giving us, like, food and drink. But as they were giving that to us, they were telling us, "Next time, let us know so we have food and drink for you." It was just so impressive to me. I really and thoroughly enjoyed that because, you know, I knew that I was there to get a different understanding, you know, but I didn't realize it was going to be that positive at all. You know, it was. Did you through your studies? Or teaching or of pastoring, did you ever have any Christians meet your message with some kind of like caution or even denial over it? Or
yeah, sure. I think, you know, some people, you know, it's very strange when I just give presentations about Muhammad and the Quran, because in Christianity, it's almost strange when you just don't come out very negative right away, you know, just come down hard of, you know, we got to be careful and these are dangerous. It's a dangerous religion, dangerous. And just to look at it, you know, somewhat objectively, I mean, obviously we all have a hard time being completely objective, and probably aren't completely objective, but yeah, I mean, for instance, yeah, I can't remember if it was that exact year that we went with your class, because I went three different years, but I remember when we had the reaction papers, a couple of the students wrote, we weren't sure if we should take that food that they gave us, because we thought maybe they might be trying to poison us. And I just remember thinking, you know, that's really... I know those guys, because, I mean, that's probably why we hadn't had real great communication, is because I went there quite often, and a lot of them ended up becoming my friends there at that mosque. And I remember, actually, I told them, I said, you know, a couple of our students wrote this, and you could just see almost the pain in their face. Because, as one Muslim told me, this just blew me away. I was trying to learn Arabic, and I was going over to his house every Sunday morning, and every Sunday morning I'd get there, he'd run to the fridge and grab me either some baklava or some Pepsi or Mountain Dew or just, you know, anything. And he would bring it out to me. And I finally told him, I said, "Listen, you don't have to do this. We're friends. I get it that this is a cultural thing, but I'm just coming, you know. I really appreciate that you're helping me learn the language." And he told me this. He said, "Doug, if I had one cow and my whole livelihood was based on my income from that one cow, and I came and you came to my house and I had nothing in the cupboards," he said, "I would have to go out and kill that cow and make you a feast." I said, "Well, why is it? Why do you have to do that?" He said, "Because it's such a shame for me that you would come to my house as a guest and I wouldn't do something for you. You're honoring me by coming to my house and showing that I'm valuable to you, that I'm coming over here." And I said, "Well, how do you get rid of that shame then?" He said, "Yeah, I can never get rid of that shame. It will stay with me the rest of my life." So I saw that this was their mentality of And that's probably almost more cultural than even just religious. I mean, if you look at Abraham in the Old Testament,
right,
very hospitable. And, you know, he's called the father of the faithful. And when I was living in Azerbaijan, our Adventists were the same way.
The whole concept of Zinia, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you take something if you go to somebody's house to give them. And if you're there, you feed and you're a good host. So, yeah, you know, but I mean, kind of back to the original question, though, of, yeah, I've had people that have, you know, accused me of being enamored with Islam and not really, you know, believing our faith. And, yeah. I mean, I don't really want to say where that's happened.
Right, yeah, you don't have
but
to.
But it has happened.
I guess the important thing, the way to combat that is to get to know the other person, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other party in the conversation we should be having. What do you think this book or this topic is important to Adventists in especially? Is that I don't ever hear Islam brought up almost ever on a Saturday sermon.
Yeah. I'll start with this. This is why I think it's important. I have other friends that are really involved in Islam, reaching out to Muslims. Number one, there are very few of us even making an attempt in North America. There are 3 to 5 million Muslims living here. When we read quotes from Spirit of Prophecy that in God's design, He brings people here from other countries to countries we can't go to and tell any type of good news because there's no legal framework with even to have a church there in some of these countries. And they're living literally in our neighborhoods. So that's the first, you know, overwhelming reason is that I believe it's in God's design that He gave us this message. As Adventists, that's one reason why most churches, if they work outside of the U.S. at all, they're in maybe 20 countries. We're in 200. That's because we have a unique understanding of our message and that it is a worldwide message. Mm-hmm. And in my understanding of how things have gone, God has allowed, you know, them, many people from many countries, not just one country, to come right and live in our cities and our towns that we couldn't even go, even if we wanted to, in areas of the world I used to work in, mm-hmm. that they're here now. Number two is, this one guy told me that works with Muslims, he asked Adventists, okay, let's say, here's a stage. Here's some Christians over here. Let's just say Catholic Christians. Here's some Muslims over here. Which side would you feel more comfortable with? Who do you want to join? And he said almost 100% of the time, Adventists will gravitate towards the Christian delegation. Mm-hmm. Say, yeah, we just don't feel comfortable in, you know, they're kind of the other. They're a bit, maybe a bit dangerous even. So why would we? So in my book, I make a special point to remind Adventists what we even believe as far as our understanding of prophecy and how it's going to come about is where is the greatest danger? Is it from other world religions? Or is it from within the chosen, as we understand it, religion? Mm-hmm. And our traditional historical understanding of that is that the Antichrist power is strongest from the people that appear to be closest to Christ. So if you look, for instance, at the church of the Middle Ages, and it wasn't, you know, a lot of times we just talk about the church in Rome, but where I was living was a church in Constantinople. Anytime a church, regardless of denominations, we don't have to bash a denomination, but it becomes a government religion,
mm-hmm.
it's oppressive. And that's the way it became for over 1,000 years. And even if we look at history, historically, as an Adventist, we can say that Islam played a positive role even in Christian history. And that's unique to us in Adventism versus other Christian denominations.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for instance, Martin Luther was able, and I talk about it in the book, how he was able to do his preaching and not be persecuted by fellow Christian powers because of the Muslim threat. I mean, God brought the Muslims right at that time, and the Christians were distracted. They couldn't wipe out the Reformation because, you know, here at that time, the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, was banging on the doors of Vienna. If you look at where Islam ended up spreading, it ended up spreading and basically keeping Christians somewhat honest on issues like icon worship, polytheism, which Christianity was not only dabbling with. I mean, Mary had become a goddess, somebody to be worshipped, which was not biblical. And Muslims were very quick to call them out on that, and the Quran talks about that. So, if you want to look at urgency, I think my friends have told me some of their other non-Adventist Christian friends who do outreach to Muslims, they tell them, Adventists, they say, you guys are perfectly designed for reaching out to Muslims. Because, number one, you're not just lock, stock, and barrel with the rest of Christianity, which has had historical issues with Islam. And number two, social lifestyle issues, not eating unclean meats, not drinking alcohol. This all automatically gives you an in when they hear that. I mean, I remember, you know, when I was here at Union, I would have my Muslim friends come on campus to Union College, and I remember I had about three or four of them tell me, they said, this is the best place for a Muslim to study in Lincoln. Especially after going to the cafeteria, because I said, you know, guys, we don't have any pepperoni pizza here. They said, this is the best place for a Muslim. Everything is halal in your kitchen.
That's awesome.
So it was, I think, you know, we're never to boast in ourselves. We boast, you know, the Bible says if we're going to boast, let's boast about that we understand and know, you know, the mercy of God and his character.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, if you follow him, you'll be the head, not the tail. And this is my attempt to help us be the head and not the tail.
Right, be more proactive.
Proactive, yeah.
Yeah. I talked to Chris Blake recently, and he talked about the work that you did with the interfaith community here.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me something about that? Or?
Yeah, we actually, well, the first thing I went to, interestingly enough, interfaith-wise, when I was, because I just moved back from overseas, and quite frankly, it was a little boring, you know, just hanging out with Midwestern, you know, Christians. So I was looking for, you know, to meet some of the other immigrant groups and other faith groups. And there was an Abrahamic Faiths dinner where it was especially Jewish, Christian, and Islamic. Hmm. And an Islamic organization actually held it. And I remember the topic was hospitality. And they had three representatives, one from each religion, talk about what it means to be a follower of Abraham and how it relates to hospitality. So that was my first in, and it was fascinating to listen and to think, wow, you know, we do have this in common. We can't deny that. Yes, we have a specific message as Adventists we want to tell the world, but we also have, you know, many aspects of our messages that we share with other people. So once I saw that, I realized again, you know, even though we have quite a high population of Adventists here in Lincoln, Adventists weren't particularly well represented in doing interfaith events, probably because our understanding of ecumenism and the role
mm-hmm.
that it would, you know, probably play in our understanding of end time events. But on the other hand, I saw that because of our understanding of that, the need to be involved in that to show what true, you know, if you look at the early Advent movement, it was an ecumenical movement. People from all kinds of walks of life and faiths rallied around a certain message.
Mm-hmm.
And it, for the first 20 years, we didn't even have a church organization to belong to. It was an ecumenical movement that was binding, you know, agreeing upon a certain message. So I just decided to get involved and help. And I remember, yeah, I had very interesting experiences. If you want to hear one experience.
Yeah, sure.
We were sitting around a table, and the Muslims were trying to think of where we should have the next event. And they said, okay, so if we have it at Union College, does that mean other Christians? I mean, are other Christians afraid to go to Union College? And they looked at me and asked me, and I said, I'm probably not the person to answer that. There's a Methodist minister sitting next to me. Let him answer it. So he started going into, well, you know, probably the conservative Christians, yeah, they probably don't view the Adventists quite, you know, along with them. But, you know, yeah, Presbyterians, Methodists, yeah, they probably would be open to it. But, you know, I don't know about if it's Catholic or Orthodox. You know, I don't know if they're kind of off to themselves. And probably went for 5 minutes describing all the different groups, Pentecostalism, you know, Pentecostalism. And I remember the Muslims just looked at each other afterwards. They said, wow. They said, you guys are just like us. Totally divided. And it was kind of this aha moment for all of us. Like, wait a minute. Yeah, we're all, you know, kind of off on our own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same thing in Islam. You've got the Shia and the Sunni, and they have different strands in each of those. And
right.
So it was kind of a moment when the Muslims were like, okay, so, yeah, we all saw Christianity was very
close
united and
yeah.
close-knit, and to find out you guys actually have differences as well.
Mm.
So, and actually through that whole, you know, my involvement, I actually was able to talk about my faith, you know, because people did want to know, you know, why we believe certain things. And I would say this, this is kind of an aside to, you know, working with Muslims, but I remember we were at one meeting and we were discussing what we should be even promoting. And the more we discussed it, the more we realized we really were on completely different theological pages.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I just shared what our denomination has done. I said, you know, really, we view, our theology says that God is big enough that he actually gives people religious freedom, and we really want to fight for that,
mm-hmm.
for religious freedom. So even if you as a Mormon, there were Mormons there, you as a Jehovah's Witness or Muslim or Catholic or Episcopal, if you have religious problems at work, we'll go to fight for you. Because if we believe that God's highest value is religious freedom. And I remember it just changed the dynamic of the meeting. They're like, yeah, we, you know, as a community, that's what we really need to fight for is religious freedom, because this is really the core issue is that, yeah, I mean, we're all going to have to, as Paul says, give an account before God someday.
Mm-hmm.
But where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. So people should be able to think, to discuss, to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
That was a good...
Yeah.
What would you call it? A good moment. And it was, one, because I really did see a lot of them were very concerned about, especially the poor, the marginalized of our society. And to not be involved in it, it kind of gives the impression that somehow we're not concerned about some of those issues.
Right. Yeah. So what are some like proactive ways you think?
Well, you know, most towns have like a mayor's prayer breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
I was always involved in that. That was kind of our main thing we planned through the year. You know, I think we can promote that, praying for our community. I mean, it's a biblical concept. Paul says we should be praying for the people in power, our communities, for the well-being. Even told God told them to pray for the Babylonians that they'd mm-hmm. prosper, because they would prosper too. So, you know, that would be probably the most proactive way. Most towns in our union have Thanksgiving services, Easter services, where they have, you know, just a general Christian service, Christmas services.
Mm-hmm.
I know in the towns that I'm at, I'm still involved with ministerial associations. We still do those type of services. I still go to them. I know, you know, some Adventists don't particularly care for it, so you need to do it according to your conscience and what type of service you can support.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that what I kept getting is when I was involved with these people, they'd ask me, oh, so you guys are Christians. Because there is the thought in the rest of Christianity that we're not even Christians. We don't really believe in Christ and his salvation. So I have found that to be a, you know, a helpful thing. You know, if anybody's listening and you're in a big city, I think there are some organizations, maybe ministerial associations, that are trying to reach out to, you know, like here in Lincoln, the Interfaith Group was not just for, and there was that push at times to just make it a Christian thing. So we were starting to allow Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, other world religions into them. When I was at Union, I scheduled a couple. I don't know if you came to any of them. Yeah, when we had
the dinners.
Yeah, like a dinner, and then one time we had a round table, I think, where we just took the topic of, I remember once we took the topic of role of women in religion, and we heard the Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, and Christian perspective on that. And one time we did the environment. And those were interesting meetings. You know, I know some people don't, you know, think that we should be doing that, but I found you can make friends because they see we're actually trying to understand and not just trying to promote our own understanding.
Or you're not selling something, you just make an effort to get to know them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to cover about the book or?
No, most people that, I wouldn't even say they're reading it. Most people are come up to me and say, "Well, we're working through your book," so they don't really say, "Yeah, we're enjoying reading it." You know, it's not just something to sit down. It's something that, you know, you kind of have to study.
Right.
So I would, and I don't particularly care. I think I make $1 about off of each book that gets sold, so I'm not going to become wealthy anytime doing it, but I'm more concerned that people actually give it the time of day to think about the issue. Lincoln, Nebraska here, we have over 10,000 Muslims living here. Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I'm at, we have well over 100,000. Denver, Colorado, I know has quite a few. Places like
Kansas City,
yeah. Even what was a place in Missouri that I was at? I was surprised there were a lot of Somalian, or was it Somalians?
Yeah, well, the Midwest is a hub for
refugee
settlement here. Yeah.
So I would say to any listener that you might think, oh, a lot of people are probably doing stuff. It's not really. It's actually a very, very small minority. And what I found is that when you, I guess it's more personal for me because I lived 8 years in a country that was not my own. And I didn't know the language of that local country usually, didn't know all the customs, was an outsider. You're more open to somebody just being nice to you. Just being nice. I mean, this is what prophecy tells us. Just being kind. This is the kind of the base of Christianity. I mean, if you look at Jesus' ministry, it was one of, you know, if there were anybody that should have been talking about his divinity, it was him. And yet we find he didn't talk about it that much. He went around the vast majority of his time really just being nice to people. I mean,
yeah, it's true. Wow.
And talk, you know, Mrs. White tells us, she says his favorite topic was to talk about God's parental mercy. And that was his favorite topic. And I think that's a topic we can talk about with anybody, is the love of God. And that would lead to more, I think, deeper, you know, theological discussions later. But that's a base to start off with.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming in. I really appreciate talking with you, and every time I talk to you, I really enjoy it. So
good. Yeah. Well, you were a great student, Pablo. I remember you did well in your in my class. So thanks for having me in.
Thanks for listening to The Advance. Please join us next time.